Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro, both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international volleyball coach, and the show's resident stat guy.
We had a couple firsts this week, and quite by coincidence, these occurrences lined up with the matches that we were going to talk about this week. So there's your hint as to which matches we're going to talk about. Any guesses? You've probably read the title already, so you already know. But if you haven't, take a guess. Other than those things, PVF was heavily backloaded this week, which unfortunately does not line up with our recording schedule. So we are going to be a little sparse in that area, but the other leagues and news are business as usual. We always look forward to talking volleyball and sharing our thoughts with you guys. So let's get started. Okay, as we said, we wrapped up the Champions League quarterfinals last week. So the international leagues, if they haven't started already, are getting into their playoffs now. So we highly recommend if you have Volleyball World TV or anything like that, there are some league matches that you'll be able to check out. Playoffs are always a fun time. So I know for sure that Volleyball World TV has the Italian leagues for men and women, the Polish leagues, maybe other ones, but I know those ones for sure. But we actually got a question this week that was basically asking if the Champions League Women's Tournament quarterfinals was last week and the men's, and it's another month before they play again, what do they do in the meantime? That is what they're doing. They are playing their country leagues. So as we kind of explained, Champions League brings teams from all the European countries to find out the continental champion. But in the meantime, while they're playing that, they're also playing their championships within their own countries. So that is what they're doing in the meantime. The leagues are finishing up, and then the Champions League semis are like the culmination of the season. On the NCAA men's side, we had some very interesting results this week. Things were a little bit messy. So this is very entertaining given everything that's at stake with the NCAA tournament.
Well, and what Sarah means by at stake is let's go over the national qualification process for NCAA men's in case anybody doesn't know. It's very different from the women's. So on the men's side, only 8 teams qualify for nationals.
As opposed to the 64 for women.
A lot less opportunity here. So there are essentially 6 conferences that get an automatic bid into nationals if you win the conference. And those last 2 spots are coaches' poll based off the ranking of the team, which takes into account your record, strength of schedule, so on and so forth. So essentially what we're going to be looking at is an extra team coming out of the Big West Conference, which has Hawaii, UC Irvine, and Long Beach, and then the Mountain Pacific Conference, which has UCLA and USC. So those are most notably where those extra 2 teams are going to come from.
I mean, that's the assumption. Those are the teams that are ranked in the top 5, and those conferences are much stronger than the other ones. So it'll be interesting. So right now, teams are basically trying to get their position to set themselves up for their conference tournament. Because even if you win the regular season, it doesn't really matter. You have to win the conference tournament and then do well enough as well to get the 1 of 2 at-large bids. It's absolutely wild.
It's so hard to qualify. And coming first in your conference generally makes a huge difference. Because if you look at the conference, there's 2 or 3 legitimate contenders in each of those. So if you finish first in your conference, you get a quote-unquote easier semi. And you don't have to win back-to-back tough matches to qualify. So there's a lot on the line.
Which brings us back to the results from this week. And let me tell you, some of these teams are probably really kicking themselves. Let's get started. Okay. Number 14, Ball State. Not really in the conversation, but they got beat by Quincy in five. But then they followed that up by beating number 10, McKendree, in four. Now, McKendree also dropped their second match of the week to number 17, Ohio State, in five. So going into this week, McKendree was on top of the MEVA, and they have now put themselves in a really tough position, and they are tied with Loyola Chicago. Is that correct?
That's correct. And looking at that McKendree game, not the best. Sam Hoskin had 33 attempts and hit 061, and Kevin Schuvel had 35 sets and hit 171. Those were their top two players, and those numbers just aren't good enough to cut it. They hit 199 as a team. They had 16 blocks and 51 digs. Like, they didn't play
really good, actually.
Poorly, but their top players needed to be a little bit better.
They kept the ball off the ground, but they couldn't put the ball on the ground on the other side, seems like.
Because if you look at the Ohio players, so Shane Wetzel, who was their top guy who got set the most, had 46 attempts and hit 196, so better than both of them. And then
still not amazing, but
no, but just better than the opposing team. And then Stanislav Chachinski hit 286 on that match. So he was actually the top player in terms of percentage. Now, the one big difference in that match was Ohio State had 8 aces to 16 errors, which is a pretty good ratio, but they only had 6 blocks compared to McKendree's 16. So McKendree outblocked them, but Ohio State outdug them and had a better hitting percentage.
Ohio State outdug them?
68 to 51.
That is like the highest dig total in men's volleyball like I've seen recently.
Yeah, so back and forth, close game, but Ohio State managed to edge them, and that was not a great week for McKendree.
They're going to want this week back. Absolutely. Because they're going to need to get it together, or else they're going to end up matching up with Lewis probably in the semis for MEVA, which I'd rather not. So that was one thing that happened. Going to the Big West, number 18 UC Santa Barbara beat number 8 CSUN twice. First in five, then in four.
So this puts CSUN winless in the conference so far. And we'll get into this later on in our game, but they are hurting with those two losses.
I don't want to say I told you so, but like, you guys, we have been asking why the heck this team is ranked in the top 10 for weeks.
Well, their star player, Jaden Phillips, did not have a good week. In the first match, he got set 35 times. He hit negative 057. And in the second match, he got set 33 times and hit 091.
Oh, dear.
And that is just not going to cut it. Now, statistically, the matches were incredibly close. Across the board, serving.
Well, yeah, they will be close. A matchup like that, I'm sorry. I've seen UC Santa Barbara play a few times. They just aren't. They don't have it. Okay? I hate to say it. They're not that good. But
I mean, to me, looking at this, though, CSUN, it was like they played two different matches within that first game. They hit 074 in the first set, right? But then they proceeded to hit 478 and 464 in sets 2 and 3. And then they dropped to 111 and 163 in 4 and 5. Like, there was just no consistency across that board. And looking at it, UCSB hit 350 versus CSUN's 234. At the end of the day, that's the difference. But CSUN is winless in conference play. And their conference,
and they lost to Loyola last week on their like week off.
Yeah. And their conference is very challenging. So they were, I don't want to say they were unprepared, because I don't know, but that is not a week you can have in that conference.
I mean, let's not kid ourselves. CSUN was not coming out of the Big West, period, unless something crazy happened, but they're really not doing themselves any favors. Neither of these teams are ranked, but you know how much I love talking about Penn State this season. So Charleston, West Virginia beat them again. Pretty sure they beat them earlier in the season, this time in four. Luckily, Penn State has finally dropped out of the rankings, because I think the voters were just like, you know what, we tried our best to keep you here, and we just can't anymore. George Mason finally broke into the top 20 this past week, and then they went and lost to Harvard 3-0.
We are saying just, it was a week of inconsistency.
It is. I was like, this is an insane week. Goodbye, George Mason. You're probably out of the top 20 again. The last upset, I would say, is Long Beach State and UC Irvine. They traded sweeps with both teams winning on the road. This was Long Beach State's first loss of the season, so we have no more unbeaten teams in NCAA men's volleyball. This was a 1-5 matchup, but I think given the sentiment around Long Beach State and their dominance this year, people consider it an upset.
We'll talk about this.
We're going to talk about this one. We have been like ready and gearing up for this matchup and beach playing Hawaii for a long time. So we will dive into that later. Back on track, UCLA beat Pepperdine handily in both of their matches. They won in 3 and 4. And USC beat GCU in 4 in both of their matches. So there wasn't all unexpected things going on, but just like the teams that were either making strides and needed to keep riding that wave, or the teams that needed to stay consistent to give themselves a chance, really messed up this week. And it will be interesting to see how teams recover from this later.
In love this week, we saw Atlanta and Houston battling it out for first in the division. Not really. Atlanta's record's better.
Atlanta,
but
nobody can catch them.
As the top two teams in the league. And Atlanta beat Houston for the first time 3-1. We're going to talk about this match later on. But I think that was a really big win for Atlanta. The weekend with Love saw Omaha finally getting a win. So there is now a green circle on the website next to Omaha, which is great. Hasn't been there for a while. They beat Austin 3-2. But then they followed that up with a 3-2 loss to Salt Lake City. At least they got a win, though. I think that's important for them.
It would have been really rough if they've just been like, you know what, we lost 7 in a row. Like them and Madison just completely switching places. So at least they have that little
green tick
of happiness.
Madison had a good weekend also beating Austin 3-2. So they're continuing to put wins on the board and trying to solidify themselves in that third place spot. So if we look at the standings now, because there's only 1 week left in the season before the playoffs, Atlanta has locked up first, Houston is in second, Madison in third, Salt Lake in fourth, Austin and Omaha are at the bottom. They're tied for last place, so somebody will probably take that spot next week when
somebody
they play.
Somebody will just earn that spot outright.
Yeah, so we'll see how that plays out. It's pretty much set, although Madison and Salt Lake both have a game in hand, and Madison's playing Houston next week, so they could finish second. We'll see how that shakes out.
They could. Madison needs to win both.
Yeah.
And there's variables that have to happen here, but there is a chance that Madison could go from the basement to second.
I personally think that's unlikely, but we will see if they can pull it off. Finishing up with the PVF, as we mentioned, there's a ton of games on Sunday. So as we record this, we don't know what those results are going to be, but what did happen was Atlanta had a good week. They beat both Columbus and San Diego. Grand Rapids beat Columbus in 5. Omaha beat Vegas in 3. So the win streak for Vegas is over.
Yeah, that was short-lived. That was like the Omaha Love situation.
Correct.
They came back for a brief spotlight, and then that's it.
So Atlanta has a couple more games than everybody else, but they are primed to take second over Orlando shortly. Orlando's looking like they could be dropping into fourth soon. We'll see what happens. But if those predictions hold true, we're looking at a result of Omaha first, Atlanta, Indy, and Orlando as the top four teams. And the top four go into the playoffs. So this jockeying, these positions are important as the top four teams qualify for the playoffs. So as we come down the stretch, we'll see what happens. Vegas is knocking on the door. They're going to have to win. But those top four are looking solid-ish at this point.
Vegas is going to have to make some big moves if they want a chance at this point, I think, because I want to say the top four all have a minimum of 11 wins, and Vegas is in 5th with 8.
And at least one game in hand, I believe. So we'll see.
I mean, Atlanta has played so many more matches than everybody.
Yeah. Vegas needs to start winning. They need a winning streak, period.
Yeah, otherwise, they need a winning streak, and Orlando needs to stop losing because they're about to plummet. Our first feature match of the week is Love Atlanta versus Houston. What were your initial thoughts or primary takeaways watching this one?
So I thought Houston looked really good to start. I thought they served well. They put Atlanta in passing trouble. Adams struggled to pass. I thought their defensive system was really good. They dug a ton of tips. They kept the ball alive. It looked like they had a strategy of tipping at Atlanta, who could not pick up those tips in the front court that were kind of halfway in between position one and position four. I thought Jordan Thompson looked good. I thought Houston was going to win 3-0. Atlanta looked flat. They looked disengaged, like they had already won the league. And
which they have.
Yeah. And so, you know, I can't say I was too surprised watching the first set. And I was like, all right, here we go, 3-0, wrap it up. Doesn't matter. We're moving on to the playoffs. What about you?
It was a really, I want to say almost frustrating match to watch because it was just like really messy. Like you were talking about Houston serving. I personally thought that Houston missed a ton of serves like the whole match. It was wild to me just over and over again. Atlanta looked like they were on a different planet in the first set. Just, I don't want to say not putting the effort in, but like if a player was blocked, people were standing and watching. If a ball was tipped, people were standing and watching. It was just like not clean, disciplined volleyball. And after the score of the first set, I was like, it was like embarrassing. It was like 25-13 or something.
So I want to go back to the serving for one point because I think it's really
interesting.
Because
you're wrong and no, I definitely want to tell you.
No, you're not wrong, but... So they had 13 errors in four sets, which isn't terrible. They had seven aces. But the issue was they missed a serve every time there was a break or a stoppage in the play.
Fair. Like seven aces, 13 errors is not bad. Like for women's volleyball, that might be like slightly high.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe it was that. Like
it
just
became
very
obvious.
It was the
timing of the misses.
Yeah.
And the other thing about this game, nobody's fault of their own. There were so many challenges and stoppages in play that the rhythm and the flow of the game was broken, in my opinion.
Houston challenged everything.
Yeah.
But I was like, how does he keep getting challenges? Because they didn't win many of them.
Well, to a set, I mean, you can have up to eight like, and you have timeouts. It was very disjointed in that regard. But almost all of their service misses came after those breaks in play, which I thought killed them down the stretch.
Okay, totally fair. But after the first set, it was like opposite day. And then Houston looked completely out to lunch. And then Atlanta seemed to find their rhythm again, and players started scoring and whatnot. But it was just really hard for me to comprehend the massive swing in not just momentum, but just
execution,
attitude, intensity, what appeared to be focus. Just, yeah, I don't know.
Well, so there were a couple things that stuck out to me from a strategy standpoint. So Adam struggled at the beginning of that match. I believe she got pulled in the second set.
Yeah, her passing was
her passing wasn't very good. So she came off the court, and then Houston targeted the libero for Atlanta, who I think struggled maybe for the first four passes, but then settled in and found her rhythm, and I thought passed really well.
The first set in a bit, she struggled, yeah.
But she found her rhythm and passed well. Adams came back into the match, and Houston never adjusted their serving strategy to go back at her. And I know they were pinching her, but I'm sorry, you can still get her the ball. And Adams went off in the rest of that match from an attacking standpoint. She finished with 18 points, hitting 462 on the match after struggling in the first set. So you know that
so
that
take
means
the first set away, and it's like she hit like 700.
Yeah, it was crazy how well she played. And they never did anything, in my opinion, to really slow her down.
That was a very confusing thing to me, too. Micah Hancock's serving definitely caused issues for Atlanta in set one, particularly for the libero and the passing left side, whoever it happened to be at that time. But like my thing, and I agree with what you said, is like once your serving target finds that rhythm, you need to make an adjustment, because the Atlanta libero was just dialed in sets three and four in particular. And it's like, okay, Kelsey Cook and the libero were taking 80% of the court, yeah. I would say. So they like, they know, obviously.
Sure.
But try to serve Adams short. Try to, you know,
serve the seam between her and the libero. So there's at least a decision.
Yeah, make a decision happen. Or like serve the middle short. Try something, but they served the same person the whole match. And I'm like, this was a really good plan early, but they figured it out. It's time to adjust back.
Now, the other thing that I saw was, to me, it looked like Houston was trying to tip the ball at Atlanta in that middle court between the left court digger and whoever was digging in one. Generally, that was Fairbanks. And they didn't do a good job of covering the court on those tip situations. However, it almost seemed to me that Houston was so focused on executing that tip game plan that they weren't swinging at the ball. They weren't scoring to swing when the defense moved in on the court and kind of packed it in a little bit. They didn't adjust in that regard either. And, you know, Jordan Thompson struggled after 20.
She hit it to Kelsey Cook directly in six. Like, no movement at all.
So this was really interesting. I thought Kelsey Cook's defense was outstanding.
Oh, absolutely. It was. And I'm not trying to take anything away from her by saying that Jordan Thompson was hitting the ball right at her. No. Overall, like, Kelsey's defense kept Atlanta going and kept them in it. Because, like, she was, her, the read she had on the game, like, she was covering sideline to sideline, reading everybody. It just so happened that after 20, Jordan Thompson was just hitting to six. And I don't know if that was on purpose and they wanted to funnel her to Kelsey, give her a visual maybe of a seam, but she ate her up.
It's not very often that the game plan against a top hitter is to neutralize them with a defender, but that's exactly what happened, because when they were in one or two rotations with Kelsey in the front row with Jordan Thompson, Jordan Thompson scored.
Yeah.
As soon as she rotated to the back row, Jordan Thompson couldn't score anymore. She was moving all over the place. I thought that was either incredibly fortuitous that she was in the back row or a great game plan, because...
Well, they probably planned it.
Yeah.
Like, they probably wanted Kelsey defending their best attacker.
I thought that was the difference in the match, quite frankly, because Jordan Thompson started scoring really well, and they took that away from her.
No, we made numerous mentions while we were watching it live, and we were like, wow, her defense is outstanding.
Yeah.
She also performed offensively, too. Like, she found a new level. In set one, things were a little disjointed, but she found a new level and was very explosive offensively, too, which, as we've talked about, Cook's strengths are her ball control and defense. So, yeah. I mean, obviously her role in Love has had to be different than it has been on past teams, but I think she was great.
Those are the players that played well. Let's flip the script and talk about...
Can I just say Halasheva's blocking for Atlanta? That really impressed me too. Atlanta put up a wall on Houston. Once they figured it out, it was nice.
So give me your thoughts on Catino, who had 38 attempts and hit 079. And at the same time, if we flip sides to Houston, Jess Merzick had 26 attempts and hit 077.
Catino, I don't know what is going on. It looks like her timing is off sometimes. Like, she has a hard time identifying when to wait on her approach and when to just go. And I don't know if that's like a setter connection issue or if that's something that historically has been a problem for her. But like, there would be times where she would jump, be on her way down off the net, and then be trying to tip it. And I'm like, this isn't going to work out. Or she'd be under the ball, ball behind her head, trying to throw it for it. Like, it was not smooth. She did not look in rhythm to me at all.
Well, and Atlanta had spurts of passing issues, and it just seemed like she was never able to identify those situations and adjust her approach with those things. And if it wasn't just in the right place, it was not pretty.
It was rough. Yeah. Mrzek, on the other hand, she did nothing. Her passing was a huge liability. She was missing serves. She was looking for hands and just like hitting balls into the bleach. Like, she looked off. It was tough to watch.
7 kills, 4 errors, blocked once on 26 attempts.
Yeah, she looked disengaged to me for the whole match.
Yeah, I was really surprised to see that performance from her in this match. I thought, okay, so let me ask you this. Who do you think this match was more important for?
If I'm looking at the regular season, which in love, the regular season does not matter. So I guess if you think about it that way, because like Houston is trying to hold off Madison, nobody's going to catch Atlanta. So this one was basically like, let's hold on and make sure that we can get second. But whether they finish second or third, they're probably going to play the same team in the playoffs.
Correct.
So it's like Atlanta hasn't beaten Houston yet. And so heading into what will likely be the final, if things hold the way we think, that probably is a morale boost.
Especially after getting hammered in the first set. I thought that response from Atlanta, just to know that they can beat them, will be big going into the playoffs. So if we take this and we make the assumption that these two teams are going to play in the finals, who do you think, I mean, let's say it's Jess Mrzek and Katina who need to elevate to give their team a chance. That's to me, that's where I think the difference is going to come down to. Jordan Thompson is a bit of a wild card in terms of how she plays, but she's been pretty consistent.
Been good for the most part of the season.
And when Adams isn't in passing trouble, she attacks pretty well. Like, I think you generally kind of know what you're going to get from her. So who do you think has a better chance of elevating in the finals, Mrzek or Katina? And which one do you think is more important to their team success?
I think Mrzek has a, from what we saw from this match, I think Mrzek's baseline is like better basically. And I don't think we've seen Jess Mrzek be this bad that often. Like, Katina started the season for Atlanta and got subbed out, like switched for Grubbs, like almost immediately. So this isn't unheard of. Mm-hmm. I think so many players for Houston need to be better than they were. Because even the way that they were running their middle.
Well, that was across the board again.
It was rough. Like, the middles were getting way too tight. They were getting in front of the ball. It was hard to make a connection. They finally got off the net and were jumping behind Hancock later in the match. But it was too late at that point. Jordan Thompson, you're the go-to player. You need to figure out how to score after 20. Like, let's move it around, okay? I mean, Rischel was fine. She's there mostly for passing and defense, and if she scores points, like, amazing. So she was steady as always, but they're out of system setting too. Like, the number of balls. You were talking about how they were looking to tip. Sometimes I felt like they had no choice. Like, the setting got a little messy from their out of system setters.
Yeah, I think those are fair points. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the middles, and that's probably my last point. I thought Jimmerson did a good job of bringing energy to the floor. I thought she was somewhat of a catalyst in terms of changing the momentum or feeling of the match. She was super excited. She got really good block touches. I think the middles, all four middles on the court, in my opinion, were always getting too close to the net, so they couldn't really hit the ball. And Jimmerson was the one who had, I think, two attacks where she kind of stayed behind the setter, came into the ball, and made really good contact. If she can continue doing that, I think both teams need to run the middle more. They rely so heavily on their outside scoring that they need to be able to hold at least a little bit. We're talking, the middle's got 7 and 7 sets for Houston, and I think 8 and 6 for Atlanta. It's just, it's not enough.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, when this match comes down to it, if one team can control the middle of the court a little bit better, I think that gives them a huge advantage, especially later on in sets. And we talk about Jordan Thompson not being able to score after 20. And I'm not saying she never does, but it being
in
more difficult.
That's true.
Well, we've talked about that before in this season.
It was earlier in the season for sure.
And I think that's a byproduct of, hey, they haven't really set their middles at all during this match. Now the game's on the line. You know where it's going. We can set up on her. Whereas if you can run the middle a little bit more, I think you just make her life a little easier. So we'll see what happens.
I mean, overall, you could kind of feel this match didn't matter. I don't know if that's fair to say, but it's like, everybody makes playoffs. These teams are currently well in advance of everybody else. Like, it just seemed there was less passion, less
urgency
than, and we said a few weeks ago, we liked that we had seen that increase in love in recent weeks. And then in this match,
well, it just flipped. Houston started with urgency.
I wouldn't even call it that. They were just like better.
I mean, fair. But then when Atlanta pushed back, they kind of wilted. And Atlanta was flat in the first set. To their credit, they found it. But there was, at no point did I feel like it was intense on both sides at the same time.
Or that there was like really anything on the line.
Yeah, fair. Overall, I think this game from a playoff standpoint was more important for Atlanta to win. I think that the fact that they came back after being beaten the first set and won gives them, not that they didn't believe they could beat Houston, but it's tangible. There's a result there. So I believe we'll probably see this matchup in the finals for the gold medal. So we'll see what's different the next time they see each other.
Our second feature match of the week is Long Beach State versus UC Irvine on the NCAA men's side. We watched the first match of this series that was hosted at Long Beach. We've been saying for weeks that we wanted to see Long Beach State play a solid opponent. We were so excited to see them play either UC Irvine or Hawaii to really be pushed because, let's be honest, Long Beach State's schedule hasn't been the most challenging. Granted, they played UCLA twice and UCLA was not good. So we were excited for this.
And I don't think it disappointed. I really enjoyed the match. I was a little surprised at the outcome.
Well, all along we've been saying if UC Irvine or Hawaii can like put it together when they're playing Long Beach State, I think we will see some interesting results. And I just have to say, UC Irvine was flawless.
That was the exact word I was going to use.
That is the performance they needed to put together to have this result. So yes, they did put it all together and they won 3-0.
If you are UC Irvine, that is the perfect game. That is what you are chasing come the national championship.
I don't even think it needs to be like as good as it was.
Oh.
Like, Darcy went off on the right side, okay.
All of their outside hitters, I think, had career nights. So I need to go over this because it's just so impressive, okay? So let's start with William Darcy had 13 attempts, had 9 kills, and hit 692. That's insane. Hanno had 18 attempts, 9 kills, hit 389. And Nolan Flexen had 17 sets, 6 kills, and hit 235. If your three outside hitters are posting numbers like that, you're going to win matches, period. They were unconscious. Every time they were set, they scored. Specifically, Darcy and Hanno.
Honestly, we saw the early days of Nolan Flexen moving to the left side and them bringing Darcy in. And
not the best.
Flexen definitely wasn't looking the most comfortable on the left. I do think he's a true right side. I think that's where he belongs, period. But, you know, the coaching staff is probably like feeling like geniuses at this point for making that switch in advance of these matches because
the head coach is buying drinks for the staff after that move.
Kiriakou, the outside they had, the passing outside, he can't compete height-wise above the net with the likes of Long Beach State and Hawaii. He's a good player, good ball control, whatever, but like they needed more size to be able to push teams of that caliber. So great foresight. And they showed up. I will say Joe Carlos, I am not a fan, but I have never seen the setter for UC Irvine play as well as he did against Long Beach State. He's usually like pretty inconsistent. His set delivery is medium. He showed up.
He had a great game. And I also thought that they did a really good job of covering the liability of him blocking in the front row. So there were a few.
I was worried about that.
Yeah, there were a few times where him and Heno switched so that he was in the front row with the Long Beach setter. And now he can hit.
Not a great matchup.
Not a great matchup. He can hit the ball, obviously, but he's less of a liability there than he is blocking on the right side. And then they would run their offense from four, and Heno was out blocking at the pin, got a big block in a key situation, you know, out there. So they were creative with how they handle their limitations as a team. And, you know, we talked about them having the small left side. They made an adjustment. They have a very small setter in the front row. They're making adjustments. Like, I've been impressed with how they've analyzed their team and worked to find the best combination of players against good competition. So kudos to their coaching staff.
Yeah, and it was subtle. Like, they didn't do it all the time, but they made sure to line Carlos up with Nikolov to give them the opportunity to make it setter on setter in the front row instead of just like leaving him out to dry against like Skylar Varga or something, you know, like these little tiny tweaks, they're worth only a couple points, but those couple points can be a big difference.
Well, and when we're talking about winning the first set 27-25, like, to me that first set was critical. UC Irvine pulling out that win in overtime by 2 points, like, that gave them the momentum to go in. That's a different match if Long Beach ends up pulling out that first set, in my opinion.
But after that first set, it was domination.
They rolled after that. Well, so let's look at some of the stats for this match, because they are heavily tilted in UC Irvine's favor. So as a team, they hit 472 versus Long Beach's 274.
Like 472 as a team is insane.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. From the service line, which is generally a Long Beach strength, Long Beach made 22 service errors and only had 4 aces. UC Irvine had 8 aces on only 13 misses.
4-22 is like not okay.
But this was the most telling stat for me. If we look at the blocking numbers, which I think was the biggest discrepancy in the match, UC Irvine had 7.5 blocks to Long Beach's 0. And, you know, along with the serving issues for Long Beach, like, that's the difference in the game right there. And that's why the second two sets were 25-19, 25-19. And 2 and 3.
I mean, Long Beach relies so heavily on Nikolov's serving. He's going to set the NCAA record for aces in a season for sure. And he had 2 aces right off the bat in set one. And I was like, oh dear, here we go. But he had trouble finding it again after that first service run. And I think that really, really hurt Long Beach State because they do rely on that so much. And watching that match, I was like, dang, Beach's block defense is just like non-existent.
It was not good.
Like, in that particular match, they were a good offensive team. They ran a really good offense. The balls are delivered in a very good spot, but they didn't do anything on the defensive side. And Hrstinovich, who is among the top point scorers for them regularly, I think he really struggled.
I mean, the only player for Long Beach that I really noticed was Vargas.
Yeah, Varga, yeah.
He was the only player that, quite frankly, did anything for them. And he had a great match. He had got set 23 times, which was more than anybody else on the floor. He had 13 kills and hit 391. Like, you can't ask anything more from him in that regard. Because if you look at the other hitters who got set the next, it was, like you said, Daniel Hrstinovich got set 17 times, hit 059.
They're not used to that from him.
Sebastian Sani also got set 12 times, hit 083.
Well, Sani started and Kondev had to come in. I was curious about the Sani starting situation, but Kondev came in and I think he did a good job for them.
Yeah, 12 sets, hit 417. Like, it was fine.
But it's just like, this is the thing, is like they've played such a weak schedule that this could be good or bad in that they have played so many guys regularly. Like, if you look at their stats, like Nikolov is the only player who's played every match. And then like Varga is a consistent starter. Hrstinovic is a consistent starter. McRaven in the middle. But then it's like mixed up. And it's very all over the board for who is playing the second left side, the second middle position. And so while that's great because they're getting their guys so much experience and like the whole group is getting experience, it's also questionable because when you come into a situation like this against UC Irvine where you're actually pushed and your backs are against the wall, you haven't really worked through tough moments together because the lineup has been so variable.
Yeah. I thought UC Irvine put a perfect match on the floor and they did a great job.
They couldn't have been better.
No, I mean, they only made 4 hitting errors on the night as a team.
That's
wild.
And I'm sorry, like the serving numbers, 8 aces, what did you say? 8 aces to 13 errors for men's volleyball. That is outstanding.
So, you know, great for UC Irvine. They came out, they made the point they needed to make. Everybody was dialed in and played well. But we didn't watch it, but I have the stats. Let's talk briefly about the next night where Long Beach came out, and it was close, 25-23, 25-19, 29-27. But they came back and they beat them 3-0. And that's a great response. And I will give credit to UC Irvine. Like, I kind of felt like Long Beach was going to come out and have a match after watching that performance, and they pushed them and kept it close. Mm-hmm. But Long Beach, stats-wise, was just dominant. As a team, they hit 424.
Crazy.
De'Aris McRaven hit 556 out of the middle, only on 9 attempts, but great numbers. Nikolov decided to take the match into his own hands, had 14 swing attempts, and hit 643.
Average.
I'm going to do this by myself.
Well, he was trying to do that the night before, and he was trying he was trying too hard.
Yeah. He was fighting it.
Yeah, it just wasn't working.
And then Alex Kondev came out, had 23 sets, and hit 609. So this was...
But we were saying they are a good offensive team. What were their defensive numbers? Were they better?
They were better. So 17 serving errors still, 5 aces.
Better than 4-22.
But most importantly, they had 8.5 blocks.
Okay, there we go.
And 22 digs compared to UC Irvine's 6 blocks and 19 digs. So, like, close. It would have been a good game. I wish we could have watched it.
We had to go to the LA Kings Leafs game because Adam's a diehard Maple Leafs fan, and we could not miss that.
Priorities. You know what I mean? So... I will probably go back and watch this at some point just because I want to see what happened and I enjoy watching high-level volleyball. But I'm not surprised that Long Beach came out and made a statement after this. Now, the interesting thing is that in their conference, the Big West Conference, there are 3 very good teams. So you have Hawaii, you have Long Beach, and you have UC Irvine. And coming first in this division...
Crucial.
...is going to be so important because you avoid that 2-3 matchup. It will be really interesting to see what happens down the stretch. So that split is massive for UC Irvine. And there's going to be some really good matchups coming up.
Well,
and
Hawaii beat UC Irvine in both matches. If they can take one match out of 2 against Long Beach State, they'll probably go into the tournament as the 1 seed. And I'm pretty sure they're hosting it.
Yeah. So... it will be interesting to see what happens in this conference down the stretch. You know, I think it's really hard for a team to have an unbeaten season. You have to be so good night in and out. And let's be honest, Long Beach didn't play that poorly against UC Irvine, but you're not going to beat a team that makes 4 hitting errors on the match. Like UC Irvine was almost perfect. And so, you know, they got their loss. They got it out of the way. Nobody's thinking about a perfect season anymore. They can focus at the job at hand. Great response from Long Beach coming out 3-0, even though the matches were close. So this will be really good conference play down the stretch, and I'm looking forward to it. All right, it's game time.
Woo!
So we're gonna
that was a cheer.
We're going to pull one out that we've done before, but I like this one. So we're going to play...
I think everybody liked this one.
We're going to play Level of Concern. And so if you don't remember, I'm going to go through the levels of concern, and then I have a couple questions for Sarah, and she can tell me how she feels about these. So Level of Concern, not too worried. Number one, losing your assistant coach to head coach of a new program. So it happens.
It happens.
Not a big deal. Number two, losing a top recruit to a rival. Not ideal, manageable, but, you know, you're somewhat concerned about that. Level three, being in a 5-match losing streak.
That's pretty bad.
It's not good. Number four, Pitt losing Torrey Stafford to another school before she graduates.
Oh, we're bringing this one back. I thought we were updating the levels.
We are keeping the levels of concern the same here.
Wasn't that the worst thing that could happen last time?
No, the worst thing is Nebraska having a losing preseason.
Oh,
that is
losing preseason?
Yeah. When's the last time that happened? What? How are the Nebraska
Probably
fans?
When I lost to Florida A&M my freshman year. Just kidding. I lost 7 matches my whole career. Lay off me.
So
I
those
just flexed a little bit, sorry.
Those are your levels of concern in this game.
Oh, dear.
Okay, so question one. We're wrapping up the first season of Love. And so if you are Love, ownership, management, what is your level of concern that the PVF is winning the attendance battle and the eyes battle in the overlapping cities of Omaha and Atlanta?
Oh, wow. That's a good question.
Now,
have you looked up the attendance records or numbers and stuff?
So I did a little dive into them before I asked this question. Now, Love has not published their attendance records for the season yet. So I don't have them. We only have kind of anecdotal evidence from watching the matches online. We've had some people post about what attendance has been like who have gone to both.
And I
want to
say when they're happy with it, they post it on social media, but it doesn't happen often.
Yeah. So I can tell you that I believe Omaha for the PVF set a record of having 13,486 fans last season. And I believe they beat that this season. And when I was looking at some of the Atlanta numbers, I think it was between like an average of 3,000 or 4,000 people, a match there. So, I mean, obviously much bigger in Omaha, but take that however you want it. There's a, do you think Love kind of reached their expectation and compared to what you've seen, what would your level of concern be?
Well, I don't know. I feel like Love kind of selected smaller venues than the PVF did. So just inherently, like, even if they're at max capacity, which watching, it doesn't look like they are. Mm-hmm. But I think even at their max, like, they wouldn't be able to hit those numbers. And I think it was strategic that they picked smaller venues because they wanted it to look more packed. So I would say, sorry, I'm just looking at your, I would say they're probably sitting at losing a top recruit to a rival level of concern, because the way they set it up, they probably expected, because they're pushing like Olympians, best athletes in the world, things like that, they probably expected to draw fans away, but people watched both.
Fair enough. Okay. Now, the next couple of questions are going to be about NCAA men's volleyball, and we've talked about a couple of these, but I'm curious. So you are the coach and the athletic director at CSUN, men's volleyball.
Okay.
What is your level of concern that you will finish last in the Big West? So currently you're 0-4. You have to play Hawaii, UCSD, and UC Irvine. Those are your last conference matches.
They probably feel like they can beat UC San Diego. They probably also thought they'd beat Santa Barbara handily.
Well, UC San Diego, I believe, already has 2 wins.
No, they do.
Because you have to think that CSUN, looking at the start of the year, had their sights set on finishing fourth in that conference.
Fourth.
I mean, realistically, if their coaches were candid, they weren't going to
Isn't Santa Barbara in that conference?
Yes.
So finish ahead of San Diego and Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
Oh, got it. Okay. I think, I mean, given how they're performing and the trajectory they're on, I'm going to say losing Torrey Stafford level of concern. You don't want to mess around. You lost a great opportunity with Santa Barbara. Now what? Pressure's on.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you have to be realistic about your expectations. And obviously, Hawaii, UC Irvine, Long Beach are great teams. But when you sit down and you look at your season, you're like, okay, here's where we can realistically be. And they have fallen short of that. So I would agree with you.
Well, would CSUN ever have expected to be ranked in the top 10 this season? I don't know. Like, that's a legit question. But, like, maybe they moved up the ranks and then they started to feel like overly confident. I don't know. That is just speculation.
I would agree that it's a very high level of concern in the CSUN head offices these days. All right, question number three. What is your level of concern as McKendree, having dropped two matches this week, that you have put yourself in a position that's going to cost you the conference championship?
Nebraska having a losing preseason level of concern, because you literally had this in your hands. Even if, like, nobody probably expected McKendree to be in the conversation for winning MIVA. And they were handily in the lead. Even if they had lost one match, it would still be, like, a game in hand. But to lose two, like, granted, you played ranked opponents. But, like, my friends, you're ranked number 10. Like, you have to play ranked opponents, so... Yeah, I'd be concerned, because now your back's against the wall. You don't want to finish second or third, because then you're playing Loyola or Lewis. Probably Lewis.
Yeah, it's the alarm bells are going off at McKendree, and they need to snap out of it. I didn't look at their schedule of who they have left, but yes, you want to finish first in that conference. This was not a good week for you. My final question moves us to PBF. Vegas snapped their losing streak, won a match, and then lost again. If you are Vegas, what is your level of concern that your chances to make the playoffs are slipping away? And before you answer, I will give you this. They have 10 matches left.
They've been slipping away.
Yeah, but I mean, they have 10 matches left. Okay, they have a game in hand. I believe they're 3 wins behind. They have 4 matches versus teams above them left, and 6 matches with teams below them. And I believe they play San Diego 3 more times. How concerned are you of where you're standing and your berth to the playoffs?
How concerned are you as a head coach that you're going to be fired if you don't make playoffs?
Well, that can be a 1B.
Honestly, I would say Nebraska losing a preseason level of concern, because you guys started out the season on fire. You were number 1. And then you just took a dive. I don't know. I don't think that there's no glaring reason why this should be happening. And to go from, like, dominant to fighting for your life, that is very concerning. And I'd be even more concerned if I was the head coach and I was like, am I going to be fired after this?
That's fair. Because if you're the GM of that team, you're looking at the roster and going, we should be doing better than this. And looking at the panic that seems to be happening with the substitutions and everything else at Vegas, yeah, they should be playing meaningful games down the stretch to get into the playoffs. And that has not been the case recently. Anyway, those are your level of concern
questions. I was pretty concerned almost across the board today.
Yes. Well, there are some dire situations that have been developing in the last 2 weeks in the volleyball world. I think
my barometer was a lot higher this time than it was last time. I was pretty chill last time.
Anyway, we'll have to bring this back. Maybe this will have to be a monthly game
we play,
because I think this is a lot of fun. And let us know if you want me to update the level of concern criteria. I kind of like these
ones. Torrey Stafford leaving Pitt is always going to be on the list. I'm sorry, but that was just so out of left field.
Oh,
like, we
so
just
good.
Can't ignore it. It's that time, everybody. Time for listener questions. We have a good variety this week. I really like all of these questions very much. So let's get started. Question one, why is passing such a hard skill for outsides to develop? This person said, I feel like outsides are divided between terminators and passers, and there haven't been many who are able to do both at an elite level. And they referenced Logan Thom as being one of the most recent they can remember.
I mean, accurate.
She was incredible. So fair that you would remember her. Yes.
So there's a couple things at play here for me. One is it's generally easier to pass the ball the lower you are to the ground. So if you are generally a little bit shorter, and this doesn't go across the board, and I'm not taking anything away from shorter players who are good passes, but you have a little bit longer to move with the ball, to get a good angle and to follow it down. And it's just a little bit easier when the trajectory is kind of high to low where you're passing. Now, if you're taller, the serves come at you in the women's game specifically at a very high to low angle. So getting down and creating that angle and getting underneath the ball is generally a little more challenging for taller players. And the taller players are generally the better attackers. So again, there are different circumstances for different players, but for me, this is one of the generalizations. I'm about as tall as some of the tallest women players. I'm 6'5". I have tried to pass women serves on that low net, and the trajectory that the ball comes at you, it's challenging to get low enough and to follow it when you're that height. So there can be many reasons for this, but I think across the board, that is probably one of the generalizations I would make. What do you think?
I would build on that to say, and this is specific to the American system, the way that they have structured club volleyball and college volleyball with the substitutions available, you aren't developing players to have a complete skill set anymore because the positions are so specific now because of the in and out with everybody. There's no sense of urgency to train your bigger outsides to be able to pass. It's just like, we want to win right now. You see it at the club level in particular. Like, we want to win right now. So like, you just hit and we'll get these players to pass. And like, it allows more players to get into the game and have an impact on the court. So I think because of that, there is less emphasis on developing a full skill set. And then you see it when you start progressing, like a lot of players who maybe are really good in college have trouble making the transition to the international game because they haven't had to do that. If you look on the international side, you see more players who are capable of doing both. Granted, they are usually stronger at one skill than the other, but I think particular to the American system, it's just designed to kind of limit that development.
I think that's a very good point.
Question two, why is it when players are getting ready to serve and there's a delay in the ref blowing the whistle that the serving player will get rid of the ball to get it out of their possession? Why don't they just hold on to the ball for however long it takes the ref to blow the whistle?
This is a great question.
I loved this question.
So serving is all about routine and rhythm. And you will watch certain players stand in the court at the baseline until the ball person tosses them the ball, at which point they will walk to their serving spot and do their routine and serve the ball. And it's the same thing. When there's delay in the game, and we actually talked about this with the Houston match, and they did very poorly at this, but as a server, you do the same thing every single time. That consistency is what lends itself to you being good and getting the ball in.
It's like a free throw routine in basketball.
And you have 8 seconds from the time you get the ball to when you serve. So when you're holding on to the ball for 30 seconds, 40 seconds, everything goes haywire for you. And so you toss the ball away. When you're ready to go, you get the ball and you can reset and do your rhythm and your routine. And that's why they throw the ball away.
Routine is everything. That is why.
The next question, and I'm curious to hear your answer on this. How do you project Cameron Thorne's career? Can you really have a national team middle at that size? And could he be moved to the pin?
So the person who wrote this question alluded to the fact that Cameron Thorne transferred to UCLA to be able to get in front of then national team head coach John Spurrell every day. That didn't work out. This is a very interesting question. I don't want to put people into a box, and I hate saying what people are and aren't capable of, but I will say it is very highly unlikely that Cameron Thorne will have a national team career. When you look across the board, you're seeing middles that are 6'10", 6'11", 7 feet sometimes, you know? And while Cameron Thorne might be able to touch high, he's 6'4". It's just, he's small for an international outside even. So it's just, even though he can jump, the foresight and the anticipation skills that he would have to be able to make up for that height difference and the timing in his jumping to be able to compete above the net with the 7-foot middles he would be playing against, it's just so highly unlikely that I can't see them taking him. I know Karch was considered an undersized left side when he played indoor, so maybe he will give him a chance. Like, I don't know, but I don't think he has the skill set to move to the pin because I don't think he has the ball control. And not to mention, he does not put enough pace on his serves to impact the game internationally. That is my take. I love Cameron Thorne. This is nothing against him. It's just, yeah.
It's a numbers game. You have three middles, on maybe four, on the U.S. national team. And that's just a really hard roster to crack. I think he could be a very good pro. I think he could have a very successful career. I can see them letting him in the training gym. He brings a different element that guys could play against. But cracking that starting roster for the U.S. is going to be challenging. All right, question four. Why do some programs, like Nebraska, run shorter beach seasons during the winter?
I do have a theory on this, and while I cannot say for certain that this is what's happening, I have a feeling. So there are limits as to how long you can train as a team, both in season and out of season, and I believe this might not be correct, but I believe in out-of-season times, you can only train 8 hours per week. And in a team setting, you can only have a maximum of 4 players in the group at a time in order to receive instruction from your coach. In order to get around that and to be able to have more time together while staying NCAA compliant, I think that is why it happens, because if they are technically running a beach team, they can train as a team for 20 hours a week instead of just 8. And the coaches can be present to give instruction to the whole group instead of just like an individual basis. So again, I'm not saying that this is 100% what is happening, but I have a feeling it is a sneaky way to stay NCAA compliant while making sure you get more training.
Sarah pulling back the curtains there and airing the NCAA dirty secrets.
I'm not saying that this is what's happening, but I'm like, it wouldn't shock me. Our last question of the week is in reference to Love and PVF. And this person asked, do you think the reason why certain teams aren't using specific athletes is because coaches want to let everyone have a chance to play and get court time?
Absolutely not.
Maybe, I don't know who this person is referring to in general. I'm wondering if it's like a Lexi Rodriguez situation, an Asia O'Neill situation. Yeah. That's who jumped into my mind.
Let me elaborate. On the Love side, it's a little different. You have one league owner, right? The coaches have generally had very good careers. They're here. There may be, and I'm not saying there is, but directives from the leagues to play some players, or I don't know how that would work. That's a possibility in that case. Also, with the love schedule, having the back-to-backs, I think if athletes have, you know, minor nagging injuries or whatever else, those may have an influence on some of those decisions. But the coaches are coaching to win, and they're not just putting people in to get playing time. I will absolutely guarantee this is not the case in the PVF. Those teams are owned by individual owners. They want to win. Those coaches are coaching for their life, for their jobs. They are
for
not,
their life. Well, it's on the line.
Their careers, right? Like, and the example that pops into my mind is Vegas. He is not rotating through players so that everybody gets equal playing time. He is trying to find a way to win. Specifically in the PVF, this is it. We're talking about professional sport. It's not fair time. It's not everybody gets a chance. There may be some small cases where the owners are saying, hey, we're looking towards the future. Like, we want to sign this player maybe a little more long term. Let's get them some playing time. Let's see what they look like. Maybe. But for the most part, all of these coaches are trying to put winning rosters on the floor because winning matters.
And, you know, maybe part of this question is coming from the fact that we've seen such drastic roster or like starting six changes in these leagues throughout the season. Like, you rarely see that in international leagues. Like, the starting six, you generally ride that for the whole season. It's very rare to change it. And so I can see maybe this question is coming from the fact that we have seen just wild changes and different starting sixes, like match to match and everything. Cause like, I've even been scratching my head at that sometimes.
Well, one thing to think about with this is that the league started very soon after the college season ended. So there will have been an influx of players who are trying to become pros. They're trying to switch gears. The coaches didn't have a preseason with them, don't know what they're expecting. So there would have been a certain level of experimentation, trying to get these young players up to speed, you know, injuries and those kind of things that affect those decisions. But trust me, the decisions are about fielding a team and making the playoffs, not about fair playing time or getting people playing time just for the sake of it. As always, thanks to everybody who submitted questions. This is actually my favorite part of the show. I like seeing what people are thinking about, what questions they have, where people's heads are at, and I enjoy discussing these answers. So thanks for taking the time to send those in to us. All right, let's look forward to your next week of volleyball. So last week, a regular season for Love, and our head-to-head match is going to be on Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern between Omaha and Atlanta.
Penthouse and basement, baby.
Yeah, great way to end the season on that one. That will be on Love Live / YouTube or DAZN.
Adam has a hate on for Love Live. That's why he always says / YouTube.
Well, I was trying to use Love Live first, and then it never works, so then it's on YouTube.
Such a bad platform. It never works.
Anyway, the weekend with Love finishes up this season in Salt Lake on Friday and Saturday. The Friday matches can be watched on ESPN+, and the Saturday matches are on Love Live or DAZN.
/ YouTube.
In NCAA men's action, Stanford and BYU have their series this Thursday and Friday, 9 p.m. Eastern on Big Ten Plus. I think those will be very good games.
Stanford BYU, I'm very curious about, yeah.
And then we have Pepperdine and USC are playing Thursday at 10 p.m. Eastern and Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern, also on Big Ten Plus. UCLA and GCU play Friday, 9 p.m. Eastern, and Saturday, 8 p.m. Eastern, also on Big Ten Plus.
The MPSF has got all the good matches this week. It wasn't like a conscious choice to just pick MPSF matches. The other ones I feel like are going to be straightforward, but after this week, who the heck knows?
And for anybody who's interested, I think you can hop onto the Big Ten Plus app or streaming service for $12 for the month. So if you're interested in watching any of that, I know we did that and it's worked out quite well for us. For the PVF, the only PVF matches this week are being played on Saturday, So if you're looking for one game specifically to watch, I think the Orlando and Omaha game at 7 p.m. Eastern is going to be really good, and you can find that on Volleyball World TV.
That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic that you want us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to us on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week.